ladies and gentlemen, you've heard what Mr. Hatley had to say. My own feeling is that the description he's given of the current rural crisis in Australia is a very accurate one. And the gravity of that crisis is not appreciated even by some of the political leaders who claim to speak for rural areas. We're on the edge of a major catastrophe. And my own belief is that something in the nature of that plan that he put forward, some type of debt moratorium to be accompanied by long-term low-interest finance as a provision for primary producers, is the absolute minimum now necessary to get our farming industries and also small business and allied industries back on their feet and try and take Australia through one of the greatest periods of disruption that we've had for a very long time. I'd like to emphasize what he said by saying that as we have this meeting, which is in the middle of October in 1985, the recent press gives some idea of the enormous problems that we face, not only inside Australia, but also overseas. For example, just the other day, a newspaper report came out in The Australian, written by Mr. Maxwell Newton, one of our economic observers, who made this prediction, which I think is realistic, and we're not getting this sort of truth from our political leaders. These were his words. The coming liquidity squeeze will produce a depression that will embody the worst aspects of the last four depressions. The post-Civil War depression, the money panic of 1907, the commodity depression of 1920 to 21, and the Great Depression of the 1930s. And that's pretty strong stuff, but I believe it's probably right. 2 days ago, the Victoria Employers Federation came out with a description of what was happening to the Australian overseas debt, which is absolutely frightening, because that debt has risen to the point where interest payments alone now are taking $11,000 million per year. It now represents the second highest item of expenditure in our budget. And if you add the interest payments that we're trying to make to the repayments on principal, we now have a repayment every year approaching $40 billion. And that takes the debt to something in the region of just under $800 for every living Australian. That is repayment alone on foreign debt, or $3,200 for the average family of a mother, father and two kids. But even worse than that is the fact that our debts overseas have now reached such a stage that we are borrowing on average $10,000 million each 12 month, which we're using to repay the debts that we've already got. And so we're just going deeper and deeper in, and it's now predicted that by 1988, when we celebrate ostensibly our bicentenary, that we could have overseas debts exceeding $100,000 million, which for a nation of Australia's size is quite catastrophic. So those are the sort of pictures you get, and the crisis which we now have in Australia, particularly as it affects farmers and small businesses, has its counterpart in all other countries in the Western world, and it's beginning to raise more and more a question as to where are we going. And then, perhaps to add something of incongruity to what I've just told you, today's Financial Review, that is October the 16th, has come out with a leading article on the front page that the banks in Australia are having record profits. This is one of the biggest years they've ever had, headed by a massive increase in profits for the Commonwealth Bank and an even greater growth in the assets which they hold, so that as industry is collapsing under the weight of debt, we're getting a bigger and bigger profit margin for the banks. And that must surely raise a few questions that need answering, and I don't believe that they're being examined correctly by those who at the moment are in a position to make decisions as to what happens to primary industry. I'd also like to stress that the very limited solutions now being given to the farmers' problems and the nation's problems are not going far enough. either from their own organisations or from opposition members in Parliament or anybody else. And the line that is being taken at the moment is that we've got to tighten our belts, that a certain number are going to have to leave the industry, we've got to work harder, and the only way Australia is ever going to get out of its mess is to export its way out of trouble. We've got to increase production, we've got to increase our exports, and somehow that is going to make it possible to pay the debts which at the moment cannot be paid. But I want to tell you that every nation in the Western world is using the same argument. They all believe that there is an export market out there that is going to solve their domestic problems, and it must be obvious to thinking people that if one nation is going to succeed in the export game, it's going to be at the expense of some other nation. And we must have a better answer than that. It is out of that type of thinking that we get trade wars, and trade wars in the end lead to military wars. But nevertheless, I believe that we can save our farming industry. Many of the families now threatened with liquidation could be saved if we can get the right policies. Our small manufacturing could be saved, and in fact, I believe we have all the potential, if we can get the right policies, to move through this crisis and to produce the genuine situation in which we can have a resurrection of genuine free enterprise, small businesses, small farms, families, rural districts, decentralization, all the things which seem impossible at the present time. If we are prepared to go through the current habit of dealing with effects to root causes. And root causes in the end must take us to the very nature of debt itself. Where does debt come from? How is it possible for not only a nation to get to the point where it is almost bankrupt, but the whole world? And if you look at the world situation, we've got debt crushing virtually every country in the world. The whole third world is collapsing under debt. We have over 30 nations in the third world which are now basically at the point of bankruptcy. Every nation in the industrial West is now facing huge debt problems, headed by America, which has a debt now of its three main areas of debt, that is government debt and corporate debt and private household debt, which has just reached $7.5 trillion. A trillion, not a billion, but $1 trillion. We've got a situation where Britain is going through a great debt crisis. New Zealand is going through a great debt crisis. The decimation of small farms is happening in all of those countries. We've got a picture where the nations in the communist bloc also suffer through debt. And in the end, it must raise this question, if the whole world is in debt, who is the mortgagee and how does it operate? And it's that question I'd like to deal with in the next few moments, if I may, because it means that we must look at the very nature of banking itself. Money has got a long history in the world. It hasn't always been money in the form that we have it in our society today. It hasn't always been in coins and notes and in checkbooks. It's been all sorts of different things. Early in man's history, it's been simple things of nature like rocks or special seashells, or it's been cattle. In fact, there are still parts of the world where the money system is, or cattle are used as part of the money system. In East Africa, where I was born and spent most of my life, there is one tribe, the Maasai, who still use cattle as money. And if you go out and offer them bits of paper, they won't accept it. They measure everything in money. They buy and sell, they trade in money, they even buy their wives for cattle, believe it or not. So cattle have been used as money in times past, and it's interesting that that is where the word pecuniary comes from. Today used as a financial term, but the word pecuniary comes from the old Latin word pecus, meaning cattle, a reference to the historical time when cattle was used. Now, before we had the sophisticated type of money system that we've got at the present time, the first money was not issued by banks at all. It was issued by individuals. As barter gradually began to change into a more sophisticated situation, instead of driving your cattle to market or your pigs to market to swap for somebody else's production, producers, and obviously in the early days it was farmers and small manufacturers, began to issue tokens. And you might find a token with John Brown's name on it, and on this token, it was understood, this token represents one of John Brown's cows, or this token represents one of Bill Smith's pigs. And so the man who was producing the pigs and the cows also produced the token, that is the actual money unit. And he used to take that unit and pay it to somebody instead of giving them a cow, and they could come back and claim their cow later if they wanted. And so there was always a relationship between the strange thing called money and the production which it was supposed to represent. And it's very important that we understand that, that money is simply a symbolic form representing what is really produced. Now, gradually that began to change, and more men shifted to the use of a single commodity. It might have been silver plate or gold plate, which they used as money to exchange things. And it was very cumbersome in the old days to go around during your daily business carrying a great big bag of gold. And when you wanted to buy something, you would take some of that gold out and you would pay for it, or you might have to have a measuring unit or a set of scales to measure the exact measurement, and it was a cumbersome way of doing it. So people used to take their gold coins and money and put it in the safe deposit of the local goldsmiths. And the local goldsmiths would issue them with a receipt. And so instead of carrying round their bags of gold, all they had in their pockets were receipts. Now this is actually the history of what once, how the money system developed. And when they took their receipt back to the goldsmith, they could get their gold out of the vault and they could use that for trading. But the next stage, quite obviously, was that instead of going back to the goldsmith every time they wanted to buy or sell something, they used to use the receipt to make payment. And Tom Brown used to give the receipt for his gold to Bill Smith, and Bill Smith could then go to, if he wanted, he could go to the goldsmith and he could get his gold out. And so the receipts began to pass around the community as a form of money instead of the gold itself. And that was the first type of check system. That's how checks actually got into the minds of men as a new idea. And more the commerce of communities in Europe began to operate round bits of paper which were passed round, which it was understood was backed by gold in the vaults of the goldsmiths in the community. Now that worked very well, and everything began to speed up. It was a very good system, provided you had the belief that when you took the receipt to the goldsmith you could get some gold out. That receipt used to go through many, many hands before it ever finally went back to the goldsmith. But the breaking point came when the goldsmiths began to notice something. They noticed that the gold used to stay in their vault sometimes for up to a year or more than a year without people coming in and getting it. In fact, the receipts were now going round so often that often the gold was completely untouched. It was only now and again a few people came in to take a little bit of the gold out. So the first great deception was started, and that was the goldsmiths, realizing that not all the gold was never out at the one time, began to issue more receipts than they had gold in their vaults. And so the first deception was used, and because people never bothered to check up on it, the goldsmiths, who charged a fee incidentally for what was in their vaults, now were getting a bigger and bigger rake-off. But the second thing that happened was that instead of the owners or producers of wealth producing their own tokens, they had passed that responsibility to a new individual, the goldsmith, who was actually issuing the money of the community in the form of receipts, which increasingly were not backed by adequate gold in his vaults. Now, that basically is how the debt system started. And from that, it has developed into a tremendously sophisticated and useful symbolic mechanism, which we call money, which works very well. It enables us to go to town and buy things, choose exactly what we want. We have price mechanisms. We can send money not only right across our nation, but right across the world simply by writing a check or even using a telephone. But it also has tremendous social dangers if the accounting mechanism behind it is not used correctly. And The basic problem in the Western world is that all money is now issued in the form of debt and interest, irrespective of how much production there is. Now, this is a fact which is not understood by the great majority of people, and I'm sorry to say, even our politicians. And the general belief that people have about the banking system was expressed in a letter by a leading politician, the Honorable Ian Sinclair, who is the leader of the National Party, in writing to one of his constituents on this question, and he made this statement. If you borrow from a financial institution, you are in fact borrowing money that other people have deposited with that institution. The institution is only a broker. It makes its profit from the margin between the interest rate it has to offer to attract deposits and the interest rate it is able to obtain from those who want to borrow money minus its cost. And you see, what Mr. Sinclair believes is that one man comes along and puts his money into the bank, and he might get, say, 7% on that, and the bank relends that money to somebody else at 10%, and the 3% margin is what the bank makes its profit on. And my own belief is that about 95% of the people in the community believe that that is how a banking system works. But it is not true. It is not true. You see, if you're prepared to go into this a little bit further, a bank does not lend its deposits. Under the Banking Acts here in Australia, it is forbidden from lending its liabilities, and deposits come under the heading of liabilities. What banks do is something entirely different. So let us imagine that you go in your own local town to see your bank manager, whichever bank it happens to be, and persuade him that you're worth an overdraft. Let's say for the sake of $10,000. In order to get that overdraft, you must convince him that you have collateral. You've got property, or you've got the means of repaying it, you've got a business, you've got a factory, and having satisfied the banker that you have that collateral, you sign a deed, which means that if you cannot pay, that property becomes his, and he extends to you credit in the form of an overdraft to the limit of $10,000 plus interest. Where does that $10,000 come from? It is created out of nothing at the point where you borrow. So in essence, when you borrow your $10,000 from the bank manager, the amount of money in Australia does not remain the same. It goes up by $10,000. That $10,000 is not taken out of somebody else's account. It is not somebody else's money that's been put in the bank. It is new money which is created at that point. Now, that is so revolutionary that people find it very difficult to accept, but the amount of evidence is now overwhelming, and my own belief is that we're not going to get an understanding amongst farm leaders of what could be done to save the farmers until they've grasped this point. Perhaps I could give you some of the evidence to back this up. Encyclopedia Britannica is absolutely specific in these words. In lending of the third type, and I'm not going to quote the whole thing, but in this particular section they are referring to bank lending, banks furnish neither their own money nor money received from others. Instead, they establish deposit credit against which the bank's customers can draw checks. These deposits are created as part of the lending operation. New money is created. New money is created. Another source of evidence. We, two of our most prominent economists here in Australia, Professor Arndt and C.P. Harris, have written a well-known textbook called The Australian Trading Banks. In that book, they have a section specially headed The Creation of Money, and these are their remarks. The process of creation of money by banks is still commonly described as involving the deposit of money by customers with banks, which can then lend out more money than they have, because some of the money they have lent out comes back to them as deposits. This was not an unreasonable description in the 17th and 18th centuries, when gold coins alone were regarded as money proper, but nowadays it is a mischievously misleading description. It is misleading because it wrongly suggests that notes and coins are, but deposits are not money, that banks merely borrow and lend money created by someone else, that deposits come into existence primarily through bank customers paying in notes and coins, and only secondly through bank lending. So there are two examples of documentary evidence that what Mr. Sinclair is saying is wrong. We could go on. In 1978, the Bank of New South Wales, which later became Westpac, produced a special report in its own journal on how the banks create money out of nothing. It was quite clear. Now, I want to say very quickly that I am not launching an attack against private banks. I would defend the right of banks to lend money. It's an essential part of our society. But creating money out of nothing is something else. The effect it has in a community is drastic. And I want to try and illustrate this by giving you a story, which is a fictional story, to show what actually happens. So if you could imagine, in your minds, a fairly big community living on an island. You can call it anything you want. You can call it Oz, or you can call it Victoria, but an island in the sea. This island is part of a number of islands within contact of each other. And on each island there lives a community. And this community has many industries. It has butchers and bakers and candlestick makers and pub keepers and all the various industries that we have in our society. On each of these islands you can find a similar type of community. The feature of these islands is plenty of production. There is no poverty, nobody's going hungry, there's plenty to go round, but their problem is they've never heard of money. So they have to exchange their goods and services by barter. And once a week they go down to a marketplace and they lay out their produce and everybody haggles and they try and exchange a pig for a pair of shoes, which is very difficult. And that's basically how the commerce of the island is carried out. There is also trade between the islands. And canoes move from one island to the next and they exchange some of their production for the other island's production. But the way they play the game under that circumstance is they see how little they can export and how much they can get back in imports, because they feel they're getting richer if they can get back more produce than they're sending out. It's different from what we're doing today. Onto this island one day arrives a man in a canoe, a stranger they've never seen before, and he gets all the people together and he says, "Haven't you heard about this stuff called money?" "No, what's money?" Well, he has to explain to them that money is a simple token system produced by men which makes it easier to exchange goods and services. He can't tell them it's wealth. Wealth to them are the things they're producing, their crops, their vegetables, their pigs, and all the things. And finally, they gradually understand that if they could have a money system, it would make life on the island a little easier. So they say, "Well, how would we start such a system?" And he said to them, "I'll make you some money. You all come back in a week's time and I'll have the money ready and we'll get the game started." So the people come back, curiously, at the end of the week, and the stranger is sitting under a big tree in the middle of the island, and he's made their money out of leather discs, which he has cut in the form of a circle, all the same shape with a mark on, and he says to them, that's the new money. And they look at it and they say, "Well, it looks like cowhide to us." "No," he said, "it's now money." "All right," they say, "well, how should we start the system going?" Now, how would you start a money system going in a community that's never had money before? About the only logical way is to give every person in the community some leather discs, ready, steady, go, and we'll see what happens. But immediately there was an argument about how to divide these leather discs up. The farmer said, "Our industry is the most important. We've got to have more leather discs than the others." The candlestick maker said, "Well, I produce all the light on the island, I should have more." The pub keeper said, "Well, I produce the most popular product on the island." And so they were all fighting away, and the stranger who'd made this money said finally, "I can see you're not going to reach any agreement. So let's say instead of dividing these leather discs out amongst you, you just borrow what you want off me. If you want to take 10, you can take 10. If you want to take 30, take 30. And they said, "Well, that might solve the argument. What are you going to get out of this?" "Oh," he said, "I'm now providing a new service. I think I should get some charge. So let us say that on every 100 leather discs that I lend out into the community, I should be able to charge an extra 3 at the end of the year." And 3 doesn't sound very much if you say it quickly. So that seemed agreeable. So in essence, what started was the first banking system. And each person on that island borrowed some money, and the man under the tree simply wrote it in his book, Joe took 10 and somebody else took 20 and Tom took 30, and it was written down carefully, and away they went with a handful of leather discs. They didn't even have anywhere to put them. They hadn't thought of pockets in those days, and that's actually how pockets were invented. So they made pockets, and they put these leather discs in their pockets, and they discovered they had a marvelous system. Instead of having to haggle away bartering, they could actually measure things with these leather discs. Something called a price came up. You measured things in prices. And after about 6 months, they wondered how they'd ever survived on that island without a money system. But the crunch came at the end of the year, because the man under the tree moved out, and he moved amongst the people, and he said to everybody, "You've now got to pay them back. You owe me that money." And that was a new problem. So the people who could pay paid, because they had more leather discs, but it meant that somebody else on the island hadn't got enough to pay their debts. But if you can consider that island as one community, the only way it could get out of debt was to put all the leather discs in circulation back under that big tree, so they were now out of circulation, and even if they went to that point, there was still a debt they couldn't pay. And that was those three extra interest leather discs on every 100 borrowed that hadn't been covered by leather at all. So they now had a debt which was greater than the amount of money in the community. Well, it didn't happen like that, because those who could pay paid, and this man simply crossed their name off the list. Well, Joe's paid, Bill hasn't paid yet. Others had to borrow some more leather discs to keep going, and it was just easy to cut out more leather discs. But now when they went away from the big tree, the whole game had changed. The game now was not how do we share our production. The game now was how do we get more leather discs than when we started. So all the farmers got together and they said, we better have a farmers' organization to defend ourselves, otherwise those people in the cities are going to put us down. Down in the city, all the workers got together and formed the first trade union movement on the island. All the little manufacturers got together and formed the first chamber of manufacturers. And in the middle of an island where there was plenty for everybody, a fierce battle began to develop. Everybody was trying to rip somebody else off. Somebody got his head broken open, and they finally had a strike, and things got so grim that one day they had a big meeting of all the people, and they said, "What's happened? What's happened? We know it's something to do with the leather disc system, but we don't know where." And one young chap said, "Well, about the only way we can solve our problem is we better get a big canoe, and we'll put more and more of our production into it. We'll send it over to that other island over there, and perhaps we can get some leather disc back from them, and that'll fix up our problem here on the island, and we'll all be out of debt." And the old people said, "That's madness. We're actually going to send all our production out, and we're going to get little bits of leather disc back, which we could cut out ourselves if we really wanted to." So they couldn't think of another way to solve it, and away through the water went a canoe loaded up with leather discs, but they met another canoe coming, and soon there was war between the islands, quite apart from the people on the island fighting. And it doesn't really matter how far you take the story, if all the leather discs in each community, or all the money in each community, is simply issued into circulation as an interest-bearing debt, it must produce tremendous friction, it must produce tremendous poverty and bankruptcy, irrespective of how much production there is. And it doesn't solve the problem simply to try and export more and more, because it produces more war. In the end, somebody must go to the source of finance, that is the banking system itself, and say it is impossible to get a fair system unless some money is created without debt. Now this raises great questions. Orthodox economists say you can't create money. That would be disastrous. They omit to mention that we are creating enormous quantities of money here in Australia every year. The money supply, which is called M3, is simply increased every year by creating more and more money. The great bulk of it, not even in notes and coins, it simply comes out as figures in books, in check accounts, right through the nation. But it all comes out as debt-bearing interest. When we started our Commonwealth Bank here in Australia, it was the intention of the Labour Party at that time to use the bank to get us out of debt. It was the intention of subsequent governments to use the bank to the point where Australia didn't have to borrow overseas. If you go back to the great arguments that raged here in Australia in the Depression, right at the end of the Depression, the Labour Party leader, Mr. John Curtin, promised he would use the Commonwealth Bank to get Australian industries and farmers back onto their feet with low interest. My own belief is that if we could get the farming community and the farm leaders here in Australia to examine this question from a new perspective, which is that we could use our banking system, particularly the Commonwealth Bank, the Primary Industry Bank, the Australian Resources Development Bank, and the Reserve Bank, to issue sufficient credit to get our rural debt down and the interest off it, we could take our farmers through. So when I hear Mr. Hatley talking about bringing interest down for a sector that is now being decimated in crisis to 4%, I think it's realistic. I know what the politicians will say. They will say, you can't do it. It would be totally uneconomic. We cannot countenance that sort of thing. But the politicians are simply repeating what convention has told them to repeat. I want to put it to you, if we don't get debt off the backs of our farmers, in 5 years' time, we will have no family farms left. It's as simple as that. So my own view is this is the last chance for farmers. The minimum needed now for the survival of farmers in Australia is interest rates down from the current level of between 15 and 20% down to 4 or 5%. A big reduction in the price of fuel, an extension of debt repayment onto a long-term basis, a reduction in rates on local government charges. Those are the minimum necessary to take our farming community through intact instead of driving them off the land. I believe that's what the farmers must ask for instead of asking for what the politicians say they might be lucky enough to get. It's a battle now between our farmers and their leaders. And that battle will be won when the leaders are more frightened of the farmers than they are of the banks who are making such enormous profits at the present time while our farmers are walking off their land. Thank you very much.